Little foggy night on old Cape Cod. A perfect night for a mystery. Tonight, Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater presents an original mystery thriller entitled Murder from the Bridge. Listen quietly for a moment. Can you hear it? Standing where you are, do you hear that sound? The endlessly repeating sound of the foghorn, of course, but every once in a while, there is something else. There. Did you hear it? It's the sound of another automobile crossing onto the Sagamore Bridge. Looking up from where you are, you can see it now. This gargantuan structure towering above you with its bridge lights nearly lost in the drifting fog. The cars that travel across are reduced by their distance to almost toy-like proportions. Listen closer now. There's another sound, a quieter sound. It is the sound of silent water swirling behind one of the huge supports. There's something down there in the dark water. Something floating just under the surface. What is that thing? Can you make it out?
Architecturally speaking, they are without question the most striking feature that one encounters when first visiting the Cape. Certainly, if you travel by car, they are an almost unavoidable encounter. I'm speaking, of course, of the two bridges, the twin spans of gleaming silver girders that stretch from one side of the Cape Cod Canal to the other. As bridges go, they are not the longest nor the tallest, although their height seems accentuated by the generally low-level surroundings of the topography. Constructed 7 miles apart along the canal, they are the only connecting link to the mainland and serve the purpose of anchoring the Cape to the continent in the same way that a pennant is tied to a flagpole. Residents of the Cape, who commute to Boston and so travel across them daily, are apt to drive over them with hardly a second glance downward to see if any large ships are passing through. For tourists, they stand as gateways to vacation land. To travel across them is to know for certain that you have finally reached Cape Cod. For the suicidally depressed, however, they've been like sirens, calling, beckoning, daring the desperate to take the final step and plunge from their heights. My name is Alexander Schofield. As a physician who has practiced for many years on the Cape, I've been aware of how powerfully these bridges could act upon the minds of those whose thoughts had turned to suicide. I knew the numbers, more than 50 recorded deaths and nearly 100 more who had threatened or made unsuccessful attempts. I had listened personally to the testimony of some of those who had come close to the brink, hearing them describe how the bridges had become like magnets, drawing them closer, pulling them in. It was as if, in contemplating a death by leaping, these bridges had somehow become personified, imbued with a sinister mind and an evil will that held sway over their own. I count myself among those who lobbied hard for the new railings that made suicide from these bridges almost an impossibility. They were put up finally in 1982, destined to save lives, but too late to save those who had gone before. Even with the addition of these safety railings, the Sagamore Bridge and the Bourne Bridge still retain a highly dramatic presence. In all the times I've driven across them, they never fail to provoke a shiver of fear as I contemplate how far up I am and how far down it would be if somehow my car were to plunge over the abyss. Then I think of what happened to the old man, and my blood turns cold with dread. The incident I'm referring to was something I learned about while having dinner at the Dock Street Chowder House. I was in the company of Captain Waverly Underhill, the retired police captain, who at this moment was participating in a little exercise that had become something of a ritual whenever we had dinners together. In its original concept, these were supposed to be lessons in the art of criminal detection, something I had dreamed up. You see, it seemed to me, since he was obviously so good at it, that it must be possible for him to elucidate his methods clearly enough that someone else, namely me, could understand them and even put them to use. Typically, at first, he resisted the idea, and finally he relented when I made him feel guilty for not even trying. I expected some sort of informal lectures on criminality, interspersed with anecdotes that would draw heavily upon his own experiences. Instead, we began by playing an infuriatingly stupid child's game called 20 Questions.
A man dies on board a sailboat in the waters off Cape Cod. How does he die?
What? You mean that's all you're going to give me?
I repeat, a man dies on board a sailboat in the waters off Cape Cod. How does he die?
Well, then, was he drowned?
No.
But did the boom hit him in the head and knock him overboard?
No.
So he didn't die in the water, he died on the boat.
That's what I said.
Well, I realize that, but I was just probing a little. Now then, we know he died on the boat. So, did the boat catch on fire?
No, it did not.
Was his death by natural causes?
No.
Was it accidental?
No.
So, it was foul play. He was murdered?
Yes.
Aha. Now we're getting somewhere. Someone came on board his boat and murdered him.
Honestly, Doctor, you physicians amaze me. You're so accustomed to rattling off rapid-fire questions at your patients so you can quickly make up an illness that you don't stop to consider how you're phrasing your questions.
What was it I said?
You asked if someone came on board his boat and murdered him. You didn't ask me if it was his boat.
All right, then. Was it his boat?
No, it was not.
It was someone else's boat, and he was a guest on board.
No, he was not.
Well, I take it there were other people on board besides him. I mean, if he was murdered, there must have been at least one other person.
Yes, yes, there were other people.
And one of them murdered him?
No.
No?
No.
Why no? How can someone murder someone if they are not there to do it? You mean the murderer was somewhere else? Back on shore?
Yes.
Well, how can a person on shore murder someone on a boat? Unless by a bullet. Was he shot?
No.
Was there a bomb planted on board?
No.
Was he given some kind of slow-acting poison that didn't take effect?
You're guessing, Doctor. Don't guess. There is a difference between asking questions and guessing.
I am trying to be logical.
Yes. Yes, be logical. But also use your imagination. Logic can only lead the mind, but the imagination can illuminate it. Sherlock Holmes was precisely wrong on this point. He said that a detective must remain logical and not allow his mind to jump to conclusions, when in fact the mind should be leaping to as many conclusions as the evidence supports. Anyone can gather evidence and interpret it logically, but it takes a strong imagination to perceive the many other possibilities that exist. When the mind sees only one possibility, it becomes stuck. That is what happened to you.
I don't even know what it is I'm supposed to be stuck on.
The image, Doctor. The image. The picture you formed in your mind when I set up the situation. I said a man dies on board a sailboat in the waters off Cape Cod. You immediately pictured a sailboat on Cape Cod Bay or Nantucket Sound or Buzzards Bay.
Well, what other water is there?
Are you forgetting the canal?
The canal? What has the canal got to do with it? Oh, now wait a minute. You said he was murdered on the boat, but the murderer was on shore.
No, Doctor. I said he was murdered and that he died on the boat. But I didn't say he was murdered on the boat.
Well, what difference does it make if he... Hold it. I just thought of something. He jumped, didn't he? No, wait. He was murdered, so he didn't jump. He was pushed. He was pushed off one of the bridges, and he landed on a sailboat passing underneath.
Bravo, Doctor. Excellent. Once you got on track, you performed brilliantly.
Well, Waverly, I have to say that certainly falls into the category of a trick question. If you hadn't given me that last clue, honestly, if I'm expected to guess these things, there ought to be at least a certain amount of realism to it. Where in the world did you come up with such an outlandish plot anyway?
Believe it or not, I didn't make it up. At least not all of it. It happens to be very similar to a case I was involved in not too many years ago, not long after my retirement. It was a murder case that had been mislabeled a suicide until I read the dead man's obituary in the newspaper and pointed out a few details to the police that caused them to quickly reopen the investigation.
Hi, are you my ride?
That's right. Hop in. You must be Chris Blackwell. My name's Waverly Underhill.
Pleased to meet you. I hope you don't mind me finishing this in front of you. The cop said they were going to be sending somebody over. They didn't say for sure what time he'd be showing up.
I had a few errands to do. I hope I didn't disrupt your day.
I don't mean to cause me any problem. After all, you're doing me a favor. Now that the investigation is over, I just sort of expected they would just call me up and tell me to come get it.
I suppose ordinarily we might have. But whenever there's been a death in the family, the department tries to go out of its way to make life a little easier on the ones who are left behind. Which is just you, isn't it?
What is?
You are the only surviving relative, isn't that right?
I guess so.
What happened to your parents?
Well, my mother died when I was 2. My dad took off before I was 3. But he's dead now.
So you were raised by your grandparents?
Pretty much.
Must have made it doubly hard on you, having lost both grandparents so close together.
Yeah, it was. I just sort of expected to see a squad car pull up. Do you work for the cops?
No, not anymore. Not officially. Not since I retired. Oh, I still help them out occasionally when they need me. It's a good excuse to get out and take a drive every now and then. That's something a fellow your age has probably never thought about. But there comes a time when you reach a certain age, you have to start asking yourself, is this it? Is this the last year I'll be permitted to drive? Every day you watch yourself becoming a little more infirm, a little more befuddled in your mind, and you realize the time's approaching when it will no longer be safe for you to get behind the wheel of a car. That was something your grandfather was having to adjust to, in addition to having just lost his wife. The revocation of his driver's license after that minor mishap on Old Kings Highway last spring was just one more thing that must have contributed to his suicidal frame of mind. Of course, not having a license didn't stop him from getting into the car that night, did it?
No, it didn't.
How tragic that was. And yet, so typical. You know, of course, that Cape Cod has a much higher than normal rate of suicide, largely due to the number of retirees living out here.
Aren't we going into Hyannis?
No, it's this way. Yes, I'm afraid it's not at all surprising that your grandfather chose to commit suicide. So often it happens that when a couple has been living together for so long, when one goes, the other is soon to follow. It's a devastating loss. I think until you've actually experienced it yourself, you can't really imagine what it's like. So it's not surprising that he decided to do it. What is surprising is that he decided to jump.
Yeah, what kind of car is this anyways?
It's a Chevy Malibu. 15 years ago, I promised myself this would be the last car I'd ever own. Now it looks like it's going to outlast me. Strange how we develop such strong attachments to our automobiles, holding on to them long after they've outlived their usefulness. We're such an odd society. We hold on to our cars, and yet we throw away people.
What do you mean?
Well, I suppose I mean the way sometimes older people are treated in our society. Something you don't really notice much until you get older. It amazes me how callous young people can be in their treatment of the elderly. Don't you agree?
Well, yeah, it's a shame.
Yes. Anyway, I was saying how really unusual it was that your grandfather decided to jump. Did you know that only 5% of the suicides in this country are death by leaping?
No kidding.
Of course, those two Cape Cod bridges are notorious. I remember I once did some checking, comparing them to the Golden Gate Bridge, which is another well-known jumping-off point. The Golden Gate stands at 265 feet, almost double the height of the Cape Cod bridges. The Golden Gate runs straight across, so its height above the water doesn't vary much. On the other hand, the Sagamore Bridge which follows a sort of brontosaurus curve as it arches over the canal, doesn't reach its highest point until the middle, which is approximately 135 feet above the waterline. More than 700 people have jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, and only 12 have survived. The numbers for the Sagamore Bridge and the Bourne Bridge are much more modest. A few over 50 people have died. Something like 8 have actually survived. Of course, surviving a leap off one of the Cape Cod bridges is entirely a matter of luck. It depends on what the tides are up to. The tides running through the canal are quite dramatic. Did you know that?
Not really.
From up on top, as you drive over, you can't really tell. It's only when you get right down next to the water that you can actually see how powerfully they run. The small boats passing through give the best indication. The ones traveling with the current are swept along, almost as if they were riding on some fast-moving conveyor belt, while the ones struggling against it seem to hang in place, barely making any headway at all. Every 6 hours, the current in the canal changes direction. It sloshes back and forth between Cape Cod Bay and Buzzards Bay, much like two big bathtubs alternately overflowing, and all that water trying to squeeze its way through a narrow trough. At its fullest, the current in the canal can actually reach speeds approaching 5 knots.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yes, and so you see, whether you survive or not depends almost entirely on what the tide is doing. When the tide is turning, then the water in the canal is relatively slack, and it's much easier for a falling body to penetrate. But when it's running at its fullest, it becomes 100% deadly. Then the water is so rigid from the turbulence that it's very much like landing on concrete. Traumatic asphyxiation is what the doctors call it. The force of the impact knocks you out, and you drown. Of course, a man of your grandfather's age and frailty wouldn't have stood much of a chance regardless
of
what...
You know, I really don't find this too interesting.
Oh, I'm sorry. I ought to realize that just because I find something interesting, not everyone is going to share the same opinion. I sometimes get accused of having a morbid fascination. But then, morbid fascinations are what police work is all about. For example, one curious thing was the fact that your grandfather's body was recovered all the way at the south entrance to the canal. Of course, the tide was responsible for this, but that was what caused a large part of the confusion, since it was assumed that he had jumped off the Bourne Bridge instead of the Sagamore Bridge. I remember reading that first article in the paper about how the body of an unidentified man dressed in a bathrobe and pajamas was found floating in the waters off Stony Point. What was it? Several days, I believe, before his abandoned car was discovered at the back of Friendly's restaurant, and the police were finally able to put two and two together and come up with an identification. Of course, you hadn't reported anything, because you hadn't gone home that night, nor for several days afterwards. Isn't it odd how some of us will put messages in bottles and fling them into the ocean, hoping they'll be found and read, while others of us will do something as symbolic as tossing ourselves off a bridge and never stop to think about who's going to know us when we're found. Tell me again, where did you say you were that night?
What? You mean the night it happened?
Yes. Yes, there was something in your statement to the police that made me think you deserved to be commended.
I went to a party.
A party. That's what it was. That was the reason. Or not because you went to the party, of course, but because, having had too much to drink, you decided to spend the night there rather than risk driving home. I remember saying to myself that even though in one respect your not going home that night was a contributing factor in your grandfather's death, still you deserve a lot of credit for showing good judgment. Too many young people today will get into their cars and drive no matter what condition they're in. But you didn't. Of course, inebriated, you might have walked home. After all, it wasn't that far. But I suppose even that can be dangerous when you've had too much to drink.
Where is this place we're going?
Just across the bridge.
crossing the bridge?
Well, that's where the car is. By the way, I wasn't implying that you ought to feel guilty for not going home that night. Even had you been aware of your grandfather's suicidal tendencies, it's almost impossible for any loving relative to be there every minute of the day and night. That's one of the reasons the group called the Samaritans got started on the Cape. So there'd always be someone to turn to in a crisis. Of course, now that we can look back on it, it's quite easy to reconstruct how it must have happened. Sometime deep in the night, your grandfather's feelings of desperation and despair must have become overwhelming. We can assume these feelings must have come on him quite suddenly. Otherwise, why would he have left the house wearing pajamas and a bathrobe? Why would he not have left behind a suicide note? And perhaps most puzzling, why would we find a grocery list all made out and sitting on the kitchen counter beside the bread box? That's strange, don't you think? Ordinarily, when a person's mind is focused on the infinite, he's not apt to be concerned about whether or not he's about to run out of tartar sauce.
Yeah, but how do we know it wasn't an old list? Maybe he just hadn't thrown it away.
Oh? Well, yes, that's true. I mean, you're absolutely right. It could have been an old list. There certainly was no date on it.
Sure, that's probably what it was.
Which is why I took the trouble of looking through his cupboards and refrigerator. And I noticed that everything on the list was something he was out of, or nearly out of.
So, what are you saying?
Only that it confirms my early suspicion that your grandfather's final bout of depression, the one which led him to commit suicide, must have come on him quite suddenly, out of the blue, or out of the black, shall we say. You can easily imagine how it must have happened. He goes out to his car. He begins driving, perhaps initially without any clear intention of heading for the bridge. Gradually, as the idea crystallizes in his mind, his resolve takes over. He arrives at the bridge, makes his first drive across, keeping his eyes straight ahead, allowing himself perhaps one quick downward glance at the darkness on the other side of the railing. He tries to imagine what it will feel like. The sudden leap, the rush of the air, the seconds slowing down, and then nothing. Driving down off the bridge, he follows the rotary around and is soon headed back in the opposite direction. With each pass he makes, he can feel his determination growing stronger and stronger. Finally, the moment comes when he decides he must do it. He stops the car, gets out, and... Now that's one thing I can't figure out.
What's that?
Why would he park the car at the bottom and walk up? Why not simply stop the car at the top of the bridge, get out, and jump? The whole thing wouldn't have taken more than a few seconds.
Maybe he thought leaving the car there would be a traffic hazard.
Oh? You mean he was just being considerate?
Something like that. It wouldn't surprise me.
Well, then you're probably right. In which case, it points even more of an accusing finger at society. Just think about it. Here was your poor grandfather on the verge of ending his own life, and he is still thinking about the safety of others. And yet, during the 8 to 10 minutes it must have taken him to walk to the top of the bridge, when by every estimation, even taking into account the lateness of the hour, at least one or two cars must have passed by and noticed an old man, barefoot and wearing a bathrobe, ascending onto the bridge. And yet, nobody stopped. No one reported it. No one even bothered to call the police. I suppose it's sort of a habit people get into, not wanting to get involved. Especially when getting involved means stepping out of your car late at night on a high bridge to confront a perfect stranger. Even so, it kind of shakes your faith in humanity. Kind of makes you feel that some people are capable of anything.
Look, do we have to keep talking about this?
Oh, I'm sorry. I keep forgetting myself. It's another fault of mine that I get so caught up in these things, a consequence of being retired and having too much time on my hands. What usually happens is I read about something like this in the paper, and I start mulling it over. Next thing I know, because of my background, I'm turning it into a crime. Of course, this wasn't a crime. Oh, I suppose in a way it was, but it's not like a real crime in which there are suspects and perpetrators. It was self-murder, that's what it was. And the only suspect was the victim himself. You know, I ought to get involved in some other kind of community work. Something away from police matters. Anyway, I won't keep harping on it. It's just that suicide has always been such a puzzlement to me. Even when it makes sense, it never does. Oh, well, here we are coming onto the bridge. Any boats passing through today?
A few small ones. There's a tanker tied up down by the power station. What are you doing? Why are we stopping?
There's something I want to show you.
But you can't stop here. Not on the bridge. It's dangerous.
Oh, don't worry. I've got one of these revolving red lights. I'll just put it back here on the window ledge. Switch it on. There. Now we'll be all right.
Now what?
Now we're getting out.
What?
Come on, I want to show you something. It'll just take a minute.
You're going to get us killed.
No, I've done this before. Come on. It'll only take a second. We have to cross over to the other side. Yes, yes, we see you. All right. Right after this one. Let's go.
I'm not coming.
Come on over, Chris. You can make it. Right after this car, it's clear. Come on.
This is crazy.
Here now, take a look down. This is really a thrill, isn't it? We're really pretty high up when you get right down to it. Look, look there. Do you see that sailboat passing beneath us? The mast on that boat has got to be 60 feet high. And yet from this perspective, it looks no taller than a stepladder.
You're right. Can we go now?
Not yet. Take a look here. Do you see this spot? This is exactly where your grandfather went over. If you look closely, you can still see where his bathrobe wiped the road grime off the railing. We found traces of this same stuff on his bathrobe. It didn't wash out. So we know this is where he had to have gone over.
I don't feel so well. I want to go back.
Oh? Oh, you're afraid of heights. All right. All right, let's return. Now, why do you suppose he did that?
Did what? Look, can't we just get down off this damn bridge?
Why would he cross over to the other side to jump? Here's the sidewalk, on this side. Presumably, he used the sidewalk when he came up here. Why would he bother crossing to the other side?
Look, how should I know? I wasn't there.
No, of course you weren't. But doesn't it strike you as odd? I could certainly understand it if he was driving his car along here, heading onto the Cape. He stops his car right about there, jumps out with the motor running, and quickly makes for the railing before he can change his mind. But walking all the way up here and then crossing over just doesn't make sense.
Maybe there was a wind blowing that night. Maybe he just didn't want to jump into the wind.
Damn, of course. That's probably it. I'll have to remember to check with the Weather Bureau. See if they can tell me which way the wind was blowing that night.
Look, do we have to keep sitting here? Can't we just go on?
All right. It's not far, anyway. We're almost there. You know, Chris, I hate to keep bringing this up, but there's one thing that still puzzles me. You remember I showed you the spot where the road grime on the railing had been wiped away? You remember that?
Yes.
I mentioned that traces of it were found embedded in the material of his bathrobe. That stuff is really hard to wash off. You need a good, strong detergent. Anyway, what was puzzling was the fact that the stains were located across his back, just below the shoulder blades. Now, how in the world could they have gotten there?
I don't know.
Because when you think about it, that railing was only a couple of inches higher than his waist. Now, if he's going to go over, he could have rolled forward on his stomach. in which case the stain should have been across his abdomen. Or he could have climbed up onto the railing, but in that case you would have expected to find the grime on his feet, or on the knees of his pajamas, or on his seat bottom. But to get it on his back like that, you'd almost have to imagine that he rested his shoulders against the railing, looking upwards, and then somehow managed to flip himself heels over head. Oh, well, never mind. Here's your grandfather's car, parked in the same spot he left it.
Yeah, well, thanks for the ride.
Oh, you're very welcome. Let's see. I have the car keys for you somewhere. Where did I put them? Oh, by the way, the police will be along shortly. They asked me to apologize to you for holding onto the car for so long.
Did the police come in?
Even in an open and shut case like this one, it was necessary that they perform all the usual tests.
Why are the police coming?
They dusted the car for fingerprints, and they found some. Some of yours, in fact.
So? That doesn't surprise me. I've driven my grandfather's car plenty of times. I'm sure my fingerprints are all over it.
I know. I know, that's exactly what I told them. Oh, check in the glove compartment, will you? See if they're in there. I'm getting so daft these days, I can never remember where I put things.
They're not in here.
Oh, well, oh, here they are. Under the seat. Right where I put them.
You said the police are coming?
Is that what I said? Gee, I don't know why.
Oh, well, never mind. Well, thanks again for the ride.
Not at all. Here we go. First, find the right key. There, now you've got it. Now unlock the door. Now squeeze in behind the wheel. Reach down to adjust the seat. Mm-hmm. Having some difficulty? What's the problem?
No problem. It's just that I have to push the seat back.
And I can't find the lever.
Oh, all right. I forgot to tell you. You see, we had to saw it off with a hacksaw. We found a very nice print on the thumb tab. One of yours.
So what? I already told you my fingerprints are all over this car.
I know, and I'm sure you thought of that. But your mistake was that you left one of them in the wrong place. The driver's seat was pushed forward, indicating that your grandfather was the last person to drive this car. Therefore, his thumbprint should have been on the handle. As yours was, the only conclusion that can be drawn is that it got there after you had murdered your grandfather and while you were setting it up to look like suicide.
No, wait a minute. I'm confused.
No, son. Don't try to explain. The police are on their way, and from now on, you'll want to be very careful about what you say. Your grandfather's problems may be over for good, but I'm afraid yours are just beginning.
You have been listening to Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater's presentation of Murder from the Bridge. Tonight's program was produced, written, and directed by Stephen Tomasoni. Co-produced by David Ellsworth. Engineered by John Todd. With sound effects by Scott Dickey. And original music composed by Mark Birmingham. The actors in tonight's play, David Ellsworth played Captain Waverly Underhill. Wally O'Hara was Dr. Alexander Schofield. And Bill Dame played Chris Blackwell, the murderer. This program was recorded at HT Recording Studio and is copyrighted by Stephen Tomasoni for Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater. All rights, including rights for broadcast and reproduction, are reserved. This is Floyd Pratt wishing you a pleasant evening and inviting you to tune in again when the fog rolls in on another chapter of Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater.